Morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, David Murray for the carrier petitioners. I will be arguing the question of whether the FCC's 2-2 deadlock vote on Verizon's forbearance petition resulted in a denial. My colleague, Mr. Wright, will be addressing the alternative arguments if the FCC's actions are viewed as resulting in a deemed grant. On March 20th, 2006, the FCC issued a news release announcing that the Verizon forbearance petition was deemed granted by operation of law under Section 10C of the Communications Act. The supposed result afforded Verizon was sweeping relief from virtually all regulation under Title II of the Communications Act for its broadband services. Statements by the then four sitting commissioners made clear that none of them believed that Verizon was entitled to such relief.
Do you doubt that the commission can revisit that?
No, I don't, Your Honor. But I don't think that moots our issue.
No, I'm not saying it does. I want to make sure where everybody, I'm going to ask everyone, that the commission can revisit that even though it is deemed granted, it's not dead.
We believe that the commission does have authority to revisit that issue, yes, Your Honor.
Go ahead.
In this case, the indication was that the agency had been unable to act on the petition within the statutory deadline established in Section 10C. But 6 months later, in response to a senatorial inquiry, FCC Chairman Martin publicly disclosed for the first time that a vote, in fact, had been taken and timely taken on Verizon's petition. And in response to a FOIA request, in January of this year, we received from the Commission the actual vote sheet. And you can find that on page 10 of our supplemental addendum in our opening brief. That vote sheet is entitled Verizon Petition for Forbearance from Title II and Computer Inquiry Rate Broadband Services. It then reflects Commission action, voting on a proposed memorandum and order granting the Verizon petition in part. And it indicates that two commissioners voted in favor and two commissioners dissented.
So if you're right that it results in a denial, Verizon could have petitioned for judicial review and got a reversal because the FCC failed to explain itself.
Well, I think the FCC did explain itself, Your Honor, and you can find that explanation in the two statements that were issued by the dissenting commissioners, where they outlined in pretty significant detail why they felt that the Verizon petition, both on its face but also in substance, did not meet the requirements of Section 10A or B, where it would harm the public interest. And the irony here, Your Honor, the illogic of this is that all four commissioners agreed that the petition should not be granted in its entirety. And yet, by treating this as a deemed grant, that's precisely what happened.
What do you do with, we have two cases that seem to me to be problems for you. One is Farmers Export, which says, this court has previously held that a tie vote by the commission is not final action, since there can be no final decision where a majority of the commission has failed to agree on the merits. The only conclusion to be drawn is that the commission has not definitively acted on the request.
Yes, Your Honor, but as you look at page 736 to 37, the court also recognizes that there may be occasions where the ability to break a deadlock vote will not occur in the foreseeable future. That was absolutely the case here. This vote was taken on the very last day of the statutory deadline established by Congress in Section 10C. I would say this is the most obvious case.
Well, of course, this case doesn't hold that. It just says they're not deciding that.
But it does hold out for the possibility of that. And in the RTNDA case, Your Honor, that's precisely what the D.C. Circuit found, that there had been a history of inability by the commissioners to reach a conclusion on whether or not to repeal the political editorial rules, that deadlock was not likely to be broken in the foreseeable future, and therefore it constituted final agency action subject to review. And the court took the two statements of the dissenting commissioners and said,
but
this is the opinion of the agency.
Right, but the commission didn't object to requiring that in that case, right?
Well, its counsel didn't object
That's
in the first
right.
hearing on that point.
Right.
But what was at play there, Your Honor, is the very long-established common law voting rule, which has been around in this country since its founding, that if you have a tie vote in an instance like this, it's a denial. It's a retention of the rules in place.
Well, doesn't seem to have been the rule. I mean, regardless of the possibility of an exception, that wasn't the rule in Farmers Export. That wasn't a rule in the Public Service Commission case, in which we said that the statement of two members of an equally divided regulatory agency possess, agency possesses no authoritative significance.
Yes, but I believe in that case it was a vote on whether or not to issue, to launch an investigation. So that was a discretionary act by the agency. It was not an act that fixed a legal right or relationship. And that's what's so critical here, Your Honor. By taking that 2-2 vote and not giving it the proper treatment of a denial, you have the carrier, Verizon, obtaining relief that none of the commissioners wanted. If you apply the common law rule...
But they obtain that relief not by virtue of the tie vote.
Well, we think, in fact, the tie vote means they don't get that relief because the petition is effectively denied. And there's nothing inconsistent, Judge Edwards, in giving that 2-2 vote, that treatment as a denial under the FCC's enabling statutes or any of its regulations. Indeed, if you look, the enabling statute allows the agency to
they
deny...
They've done nothing in time it passed. The result is the same, right?
I think if they had done nothing and the time had passed, then I think that there would have been agency in action. And therefore, the deemed grant would have occurred. But here there was agency
action. But the grant would have occurred in either case, right?
Well, here I think that the FCC's treatment of the grant having occurred was wrong because they took timely action. And in their briefs to this court, in both In Re Core and In Re Quest, the FCC has said, hey, if we take a timely vote on a forbearance petition before the 1-year 90-day period in 10C expires, we've taken timely action. And we can issue our order at some point thereafter because that's just a ministerial act. They engaged in agency action. That agency action had a legal consequence. It fixed the relationship of Verizon vis-a-vis all of its customers under Title II and the computer inquiry rules. That is the only logical way to treat what happened here, because otherwise you have a result that none of the four commissioners wanted.
But that, when you say that none of the four commissioners wanted, they all apparently thought that this was going to be deemed, right? So they knew, regardless of what they said, I don't know what reason they gave or anything else, they all acknowledged that this would be the consequence. They could have prevented that being the consequence by getting together on something. They didn't.
But Your Honor, this court has the ability to set aside, under the APA, agency conclusions that are plainly
it is,
wrong.
Maybe, but you are just saying what they actually intended. And I don't think it's, I don't see how you can read their positions as being intended when they, at least they thought it was going to have the same consequence as your opposing counsel says it has.
Well, I think what we're looking for, Your Honor, is for the court to take a look at this and say the legal effect, the legal consequence of final agency action like this is a denial. And that is the only logical result. So even if the commissioners intended otherwise, it makes no sense.
Suppose that the record compiled in FOIA indicates that two of the commissioners wanted to grant the petition in full and two wanted to deny it in full.
Then I think, Your Honor, under the common law voting rule that's been in place for centuries, that means that the presumption goes to the negative, to retention of the rules in place. There's nothing unfair about that. That's the way legislatures, courts, and agencies have...
We have a statute that says if you don't act one way or the other, within a certain period of time, it's deemed granted. And so that doesn't that reverse the common law rule?
No, I don't think it does, Your Honor. I think that the agency itself has already given its view about that matter in its core brief, which we cited our supplemental addendum at page 15, where the FCC said to this court that the statutory deadline is, quote, a mechanism to force timely action. It is not a process for wholesale revision of the act through inaction. And I think that's exactly right. Senator Dole wanted this provision in there to make sure that the FCC acted within a time period. It did here. And that's the record. Those are the facts we're dealing on. And the legal consequence of that is a denial.
And what commissioners now are?
As of June of 2006, there's been five commissioners. But again, here, Your Honor, where you had a statutory deadline and the clock was about to strike midnight, there was no opportunity, no foreseeability of breaking that deadlock. That deadlock vote. So I think very consistent with this court's views in RTNDA and Farmers Export, that's a denial.
Which is the case that you said creates this common law rule?
Yes, if you look at FTC v. Flat Hill Products, Your Honor, it's a 1967 Supreme Court
that
decision.
Was just that says that the common law rule is it's a majority of the quorum that decides rather than the majority of the whole commission.
Yes, but that's one of many common law voting rules
apply. Right, but that's not the one you need here. You need one that says that a evenly divided quorum is a denial.
That's correct.
Which common law case says that?
Well, it's the RTMDA case, Your Honor.
But that can hardly be centuries-old common law rule, since we just decided that.
No, but the RTMDA case, I believe, cites to the Thomas Jefferson Manual on House Procedure, which goes back to the founding of the country. And that includes in that manual this very rule, semper pro praesimeter pro negante.
So as Justice Roberts would say, give me English words over Latin.
Okay, thank you.
Particularly, I don't understand the words. What do those words mean?
It means that in the case of a deadlock, the presumption goes to the negative. It's a retention of the rules in place.
But even if that were the case in general, here we have a statute that tells us what to do. I mean, I'm not sure why that makes sense in a situation where Congress has said you actually have to do something in a certain way, not just leave rules in place.
Well, because there, Your Honor, the statute says you need to act within a certain time. Mm-hmm. And in this instance, the record shows the FCC did act. And it acted the best it could with four commissioners.
Even if they have internal rules that say they haven't acted?
Well, Your Honor, we asked for their internal rules, which they refused to disclose to us in our FOIA request. And I've seen nothing in the record that would suggest that they, in fact, I think if you look at the way they treat petitions for rulemaking, if there's a finding that the petition doesn't satisfy the requirements for a rule, in all cases it will be denied. The enabling statute allows the agency to deny a petition in whole or in part. I don't think there's anything in the FCC's enabling legislations or regulations that would impede the proper operation of this common law voting rule. And it makes perfect sense. And this court, in effect, gave it that treatment.
I thought the agency said a tie vote. Well, you can't look to a case where we compelled the court to vote and we then deem their action a denial. I mean, we aggressively involve ourselves. I mean, that's the best case you have. That's difficult for me.
Well, I think the best case.
But in any event, my understanding is that the agency treats a tie vote as a non-vote.
Well,
can an agency not adopt that rule?
I think that the agency, in an instance like this, where they are under a congressional mandate to act on a petition by a specified date.
And if you don't?
Then it's deemed granted. But, Your Honor, they did. They acted.
Well, but can they have, you're avoiding my question, can an agency have a procedural rule internally which says a tie vote is a non-vote as far as we're concerned? That's our procedure.
I think in this instance, Your Honor.
No, not in this application, instance, just generally.
I think generally they could have such a rule, but I think to apply that rule in this unique context would be arbitrary and capricious because it produces.
Congress didn't say in the event that your action is a tie, deem that as a denial for purposes of finality.
Your Honor, I can't imagine that Congress expected that there would be wholesale rescission.
We shouldn't go there. What Congress expected.
Let me just say what the FCC has observed about what it believes that Congress did not expect this timing mechanism to be a vehicle for wholesale revision of the 46 provisions of Title II for one of the major carriers in the United States because the agency couldn't get its act together.
Well,
it's
of course,
in there to try to get it to
that's the rule. The agency couldn't get its act together.
Right.
You do assume that that's what Congress meant, right? Forgetting about a tying vote.
Right.
If there were no vote at all, if they couldn't get their act together at all, then they would all be rescinded, right? They'd all be forborne, right?
Yes. Well, that's correct. And I will leave it to my colleague to explain why that still gives this court an opportunity to review it.
Nonetheless, Congress did obviously foresee or failed to foresee the possibility that if the agency didn't get its act together, everything would be forborne.
Yes, it did. Mm-hmm. That's not this case. Mm-hmm. I think that what Congress intended, Judge Garland, worked here because the agency got together, the four commissioners voted, there was a result. None of them wanted to grant the whole thing. To give it the effect of being wholly granted is illogical and irrational.
And what would we rely on? I know we're going to hear from your colleague in a moment, but what would we rely on to decide whether this was arbitrary and capricious or not?
I think you have an adequate record from the statements of the two dissenting commissioners.
Where are they?
They are in the joint appendix, Your Honor.
And what's your view of their statements?
I think that those statements reflect the opinion of the agency.
And they're good enough or they're not good enough?
They are good enough, and just in RTMDA, I think you can afford them Chevron deference.
No, they're good enough to uphold the forbearance or to not?
They are good enough to affirm that the legal consequence of the agency's action here was a denial of the Verizon
you
petition.
Right, the page?
Yes.
JA 33 through 37, I think.
Yes, and the particular, it's 35 to 37 is the statement of Commissioner Copps. And 38 to 40 is the statement of Commissioner Adelstein.
Your view is that if there were a denial, it was arbitrary and capricious, right?
No, if there were a denial, I think you can affirm it based on the statements.
I mean, I'm sorry.
Yes.
It was not arbitrary and capricious.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Based on the statements of the...
Of the two dissenting commissioners.
Right. So if we were to adopt your rule, we would have to be adopting a rule that the dissenters would have to know that they have to essentially write an opinion to uphold the... this kind of position,
I
right?
take your point, and I think under the unique circumstances of this case, where the two dissenters did not control the agency's action or agenda, that I think the court would have the ability to take from those statements a sufficient record to affirm. But if you didn't, then obviously this case could be sent back, like you did in RTMDA.
An odd view that the dissent has to write a complete opinion under these circumstances.
Well, that's what the court asked the two dissenting commissioners to do in RTNDA. I don't know that you have to go through that exercise here because you have, if you take a look at those statements, sufficient grounds to affirm the denial. But if there's any doubt about that, I think you can follow the same process that you did in the RTNDA case and ask them to amplify those views.
Didn't this court issue an opinion in the context of the NLRB saying that we can't find a dispositive decision from an agency when you don't have a majority position?
I'm not familiar with that case, Your Honor. I certainly have studied closely what you did in the RTNDA case.
I'm thinking you keep raising this, and I think I was on the panel. I think I may have written it, and I think my clerk will find it shortly.
And I think I'll look at it when I get back to the office. But
I thought we had addressed that kind of a situation, and so there isn't anything for us to rest on.
Oh, I think that this court has, in numerous cases, Your Honor, whether it's the Verizon case, the CBS case, this court has said we're not going to be bound by the labels that the agency puts on what it does, the fruit of its product.
No, I'm suggesting where there is no consensus in the agency hasn't done anything.
Well, Your Honor, we believe it has.
Okay.
We believe that there are very well-established principles to hold that it has and that it was a denial, and that is by far the most logical consequence.
Are these statements dated?
They were issued contemporaneously with the public notice, I believe, on or about March 20th, 2006.
How do we know them?
I think if in the body of the statement it says we are announcing today that the deemed grant. And I don't think there's any dispute among the parties that these statements accompanied the public notice. Unless there are any other questions, Your Honors? Thank you.
Morning, Your Honors. I'm Chris Wright, also representing the carrier petitioners. Chris White from the New Jersey Rate Council is here if the court has any questions about his submission. Unlike Mr. Murray, my presentation is based on the theory that Verizon's petition was deemed granted when the commission deadlocked on March 20th. In response to Judge Edwards' question, let me chime in. We have no doubt that the commission may revisit this deemed grant. We think it's very clear that they can do it here. We think in any event, we could ask for a declaratory ruling or a petition for rulemaking to have them reinstate this. While we think that that's absolutely clear, we also think that that result is perfectly consistent with the main argument I'm going to advance today, which is this, that the deemed grant should be treated as a grant by the commission, and it is at least in some tension with the government's view that this was a deemed grant by Congress. Or let me at least note that in the government's apparent view now, it was a deemed grant by Congress, but they may revisit it any time, but this court is barred from reviewing their action. In our view, the main issue is a statutory construction issue. Is a deemed grant supposed to be treated as a grant by the commission or as a grant by Congress? And the first thing to look at, we think, is the word deemed. We give meaning to the word deemed. Deemed means...
It's a problem when you use things in the passive tense, isn't it?
Well, we think it fits here. It's deemed means to treat something as if it were something else. And in our view, that something else has to be or is most logically.
But the question is, who is deemed by whom?
Right.
Which is, and that's what's missing from the statutory language.
Well, let me try to persuade you that the most logical reading is deemed by the commission. First, Section 10 is a short provision. It uses the phrase "the commission," referring to the FCC, 13 times. It calls on the FCC to review petitions. It calls on them to issue a writing. That's the last sentence of 10C. It says a lot of things about what the commission should do.
Would it matter to you if this were to be read as a congressional decision that the agency must deem it granted? So that the actual decision is, and the reason for that would be that since we're talking about forbearing from enforcement, Congress is not going to make decisions every subsequent day about enforcement, but Congress is directing that the agency is to deem it.
Okay. Please let me get back to the enforcement point, Judge Garland. But I think what's important for our purposes is how is it to be treated, and if Congress says this is to be treated like a decision by the commission, we have no problem with that because, of course, decisions by the commission are judicially reviewable in the normal case. But I don't, you've at least come up with a meaning for the word deemed that leads to some congressional action. If, in our view, the FCC really hasn't tried yet to give any meaning to deemed, if it's really a grant by Congress, then there's no reason to say deemed granted. Congress would just say it is granted. The way that in the 272 Sunset case it said that the provisions shall cease to apply. It didn't say anything about shall be deemed to apply.
Well, the reason for deemed is because everybody knows that they actually didn't do it. So deemed is as if.
Yeah, well, I'm sorry, but they, who's they? We think it's the commission. And let me say that we think that the presumption favoring judicial review, which the FCC has also not told you anything about, although we went on about it at some length in our brief, is important here. The FCC tries to assume the answer. It says that the presumption doesn't apply because this was a grant by Congress. In our view, this is a question of what a deemed grant means, and there are two possible answers. One is it's deemed granted by the commission, in which case it's judicially reviewable. And the second possibility is it was deemed granted by act of Congress, in which case it's unreviewable. We think, again, that deemed granted by the commission is the more logical interpretation, but to the extent there's doubt, that's where the presumption favoring judicial review applies.
I mean, the heart of your argument is that this doesn't happen unless the commission has something before it which it either fails or refuses to address. It doesn't otherwise, if there's nothing before it, then there's no forbearance, and the status quo is regulation.
Yes, Your Honor.
So it's only your, I mean, at bottom, all you're saying is the commission weighed in here. Now, the weighing in was their failure to do something, but they weighed in. Congress didn't say this will automatically forbear. It said only in situations where the commission has something before it and then fails or refuses to address it. We're trying to push them along. If they don't, then we'll deem it granted, but it's only in those circumstances. So you're saying, in fact, this is really agency action or inaction, which is reviewable.
Exactly right. I mean, the Section 10A and 10B say that if a party files a petition, there are a host of criteria that the commission is supposed to consider and decide whether to grant or deny. Nothing is deemed granted in the absence of a petition being filed, and in the normal case, the commission does what it's supposed to do. It ends up issuing a writing explaining why it's granting or denying.
What are we supposed to
review? Yeah, what are we supposed to do?
What are we supposed to be reviewing here?
In our view, under this view of the court, of the case, it would be the joint statement of the chairman and Commissioner Tate. Judge Randolph, you suggested that the deemed grant reversed the normal situation here, and I think this is an answer to your question, Judge Edwards, too. You know, in the normal case, Mr. Murray is exactly right. A deadlock means a denial of what happened.
I just want to go, let's not get too far
from the
question, what do we review? Now, you say we have these statements, we're supposed to review these statements. For what? They don't represent the majority of the view of the, they don't represent the commission. They don't represent a majority of the commissioners. They were never published. They're not part of the public record except through a FOIA request. But what's it matter what they said?
Your Honor, let me, I mean, they certainly were published, at least in the sense that they came out, were put on the FCC's website on March 20th, 2006. I think that they were published in the Federal Register. I can't tell you whether they were in this case or not.
They weren't published as part of an opinion. It's not like if we issued an en banc opinion and we were equally divided, there would be an opinion and each side would say what they thought, right?
Right. Your Honor, this is an unusual case. Let me also bring up the Federal Election Commission cases in addition to the RTNDA case.
But I want to know what we're supposed to review. When we have a normal case, it's easy to say that we review the order that the commission issues. There was no order here. And we also review the action that the commission takes and its explanation for the action. But here we have a bunch of statements to say, by failing to act, we have abdicated our responsibility. We should have tried to get to some sort of an agreement, blah, blah, blah. You know, what are we supposed to review?
Well, Your Honor, what will happen once this court announces that a joint statement of the controlling group is what you review is that the two commissioners who favor a grant will issue a document that looks a whole lot like a commission order that has the title joint statement on it. That's the rule this court came up with in the FEC cases.
Is it accurate to say that none of the commissioners would have granted, according to their statements, would have granted the forbearance petition in full?
Your Honor, I'm not entirely sure. I read the joint statement as saying that the chairman and Commissioner Tate would have been happy to grant the petition as limited by the ex partes that Verizon filed late in the proceeding, saying that they weren't meaning to ask for forbearance on a few matters. And it's an open question, I suppose, whether, assuming we're wrong and the petition was granted, whether the petition that was filed in December of 2004 was granted without any of the subsequent limitations that Verizon put in it on it, or whether it was granted taking into account the ex parte submissions that Verizon made late in the day, saying that they weren't seeking forbearance from certain things.
If these statements had been issued as press releases only, would you be making the same argument that we would have to rely on them to make this decision?
Yes. 2 points. First, again, for the future, if you resolve this case the way I'm suggesting, this isn't going to be a problem in the future. Second, this court has never let an agency get away with saying something's unreviewable by giving it a different title. The 42 CBS case, Supreme Court said titles don't matter. 79 AT&T case, same thing. In the Verizon forbearance case in 2004.
Obviously not saying that. What I'm asking is, your approach, which is to make something reviewable, puts us in a difficult position as to what we would review. And if we thought that, as a general matter in these cases, there would be nothing to review, because when they vote, they split this way, there is no official document telling us what their views are, that would be a reason to regard this as non-reviewable. Now, it could be we could force them to do something. We did this only in one extraordinary circumstance before. But if we weren't going to actually force them to produce things, you're leading us into a road in which we'd be asked to review materials that may or may not exist, and that certainly don't exist in a form that we would usually regard as reviewable. That's what I'm actually asking you to respond to.
Right.
Let me add to this. I did find my case. Oil Chemical versus the NLRB. And we could not get a consensus view from the board, and we sent it back and said, you in effect have acted, and you've got to act with reasoned decision making, and you've got to provide reasoned decision making for the result that you've reached. I thought that was essentially what you're arguing, that they have reason to know that a failure or refusal to do something within time produces a result, a legal consequence of that, by virtue of what Congress has said, has been established. And your argument is that's reviewable. Well, I thought your argument was it's missing reasoned decision making, and we can send it back and insist that there has to be reasoned decision making in support of that result.
Exactly so. And again, in the Federal Election Commission cases, with six-member commission that deadlocks all the time, this court had to figure out a way to have something to review. It said the controlling group, whoever is what we review. In the RTNDA case, the commission, or the court made up on the fly.
In the FEC case, though, at least your opposing counsel suggests that the statute actually has a particular provision, unlike this one, for review of inaction, right?
Well, Your Honor, the Communications Act, of course, has a provision calling for review.
Right, but that one has a specific provision about where they don't find a go forward with a complaint.
Section 402A has been called a catch-all provision that allows this court to review anything the commission does. If I could turn to your enforcement question for a minute, let me just say that, I mean, on the one hand, yeah, there's a problem trying to figure out what this court should review if you look at it my way. But I really don't think that's a problem for the future. And I really think looking at the FEC cases and RTNDA and other cases that it's pretty clear that it ought to be the joint statement of the controlling group. But there's a serious constitutional problem if entire parts of the Communications Act are essentially amended or repealed, and the commission doesn't have to explain why, and this court doesn't get to check the commission's reasoning. Chairman Powell said with respect
to... Wait, so that would apply regardless of whether there are ties or not, right?
If
they simply do exactly what Congress it appears to have at least considered, that they won't deny the petition for failure to meet the requirements for forbearance within the date.
My argument applies if the... unless the commission conducts a majority vote and
right, if they
and
just don't, don't get their act together, as your colleague said.
Yeah,
you think the statute would be unconstitutional?
As applied, I think in the normal case, it's a serious problem in our view. As it now reads, the 48 provisions in the Communications Act all essentially have a clause at the end that said, except that this provision does not apply to Verizon Communications with respect to its special access services.
But is that aspect different than a sunset provision? The constitutionality argument you're making, is that different?
Yes. I really think that case is totally different, where Congress looks at one narrow provision and says...
What if Congress says we're going to sunset this entire statute unless the agency acts within a certain date to do something?
Right. Well, I suppose Congress could do that, too. I think it's quite a different thing to take a long-standing, complex statute with 48 different provisions just in Title II and say that if a party asks that it no longer apply to it, it no longer applies to it.
What if they gave a terrible explanation, an arbitrary, they granted the petition, they give a lousy explanation, is that unconstitutional?
I think then you're in ordinary judicial review situation, and of course, if that happens, this court
should turn. What if they grant it and don't give any explanation? Is that unconstitutional?
I don't think that's unconstitutional. I think it's certainly good reason to demand that they.
But you say that's arbitrary and capricious.
That's arbitrary and capricious.
Yes.
And of course, in our view of the case, it's arbitrary and capricious. We think it's simple. This court should review the joint statement. The FCC doesn't even contend that the joint statement provides satisfactory explanation. So it's easy. But if the commission can allow forbearance petitions to be granted and choose to do nothing, then the act will be amended without any look at the intelligible principles that Congress did put in 10A and 10B. Which I think save it from any constitutional challenge when the commission analyzes those principles and this court reviews the commission's decision to check that they're okay.
Your time has expired, and we'll give you some time on the rebuttal.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. I'm Joseph Palmore here on behalf of the FCC. Section 10 of the Communications Act specifies that if the commission does not deny a forbearance petition within the statutory deadline, it is deemed granted by operation of law. The grant takes place at the direction of Congress, not the commission, and there's no agency action or agency order for this court to review. Mr. Murray and Mr. Wright had upwards of 20 minutes between them, and I never heard them definitively state, tell this court what is the order that is before it here. There is no order, and therefore this court has no jurisdiction.
Well, we order agency, we review agency cases where there's not an order there.
Sometimes in the mandamus context, you may order an agency to issue an order, but they've disclaimed any interest in mandamus in this case.
No, I understand. But I mean, so it's not novel. The appearance or non-appearance of an order is not novel. There's certainly something that has happened that wasn't there before, right? And it only happened because the agency got engaged. And it's by virtue of what the agency did or did not do that we have this legal consequence, right?
It's by virtue of the automatic operation of a statute. That's correct.
No. The automatic application only comes into play by virtue of the agency being engaged and failing to do something, right?
Failing to issue an order. That's correct. And an order is a predicate for this court's jurisdiction
under
the Hobbs Act.
Well, they could even issue an order saying we're not doing anything, and that would have the same consequence. Your argument doesn't change then, right?
No, that's correct. That was the AT&T case, in fact.
So it's not the AT&T is different, but it's not the existence or non-existence of an order that's determinative.
It is, because an order is a decisional pronouncement of an agency. It's when the majority, in the case of a multi-member agency, when the agency reaches a majority position and issues a decisional pronouncement in either its quasi-legislative or quasi-adjudicative capacity. There was no such order in this case.
And you think Congress merely meant to allow the forbearance provisions to go into play if a carrier gets lucky and comes in and says, we want everything gone? I mean, they got to go for the whole thing if what you're saying is the rule, because they may get lucky if the commission ends up in a tie vote. They're home free.
I think Congress was very concerned about agency delay. This court has said in the 2004 AT&T case that, or I'm sorry, the 2006 AT&T case, that Section 10 was kind of at the deregulatory heart. It was critical to the deregulatory purposes of the 96 Act. So Congress wanted to have a hammer over the Commission's head and force decisions when possible in order to achieve the deregulatory objectives of the statute.
No, they forced the decision.
Force a decision when possible,
No, they have forced the decision, and they say, here's how it's going to play. You know, you should be doing it, and if you don't finish in time, here's the result that you'll produce.
I think Congress clearly contemplated that in the vast majority of cases, the Commission would issue a decision and would issue an order, and in fact, history has borne out that expectation. There's order after order since 1996 in which the Commission has disposed of forbearance petitions on the merits, including seven separate petitions since the deemed grant here. There's certainly no history of the Commission seeking to use the deemed grant option.
I don't think anybody disagrees. There was no order, there was no report, there was no decision. But we also have jurisdiction under 405 of agency action, right?
I think that's a necessary but not sufficient predicate for this court's jurisdiction. I think under the Hobbs Act, you need an order and you need action.
Statute says
that's not what it says.
After an order, decision, report, or action has been made in or taken in any proceeding by the commission.
Right, but it incorporates by reference the Hobbs Act, which requires an order. But I think that the two collapse really in this case, in that both represent a decisional pronouncement by the agency, and there clearly was no such decisional pronouncement in this case.
The commissioners, at least two of them, I think, kept saying it's appalling that that we haven't taken any action in this. We haven't taken any action. We failed to take action. We failed. So, you know, it's pretty hard to see where the agency action is when the commission, two of the commissioners, are complaining that they didn't take any.
All four of the commissioners said it took no action. Said the commission took no action. They were unanimous in their view that there had not been, despite what Mr. Murray says, that there had not been a denial, for instance. They were all unanimous in their view that there had not been a grant by agency action. They were all commenting on the fact in these separate statements, none of which is an order of the commission, that something had happened by operation of law.
And that's AT&T says, you know, the public notice is not agency action.
Correct. AT&T, there was a public notice which was actually voted by the commission, and in that public notice, the commission said these sunset requirements are going to sunset as a matter of law because we are not going to issue a decision to extend them. And the holding of this court in AT&T was there was no reviewable action in that case because the commission, even by majority vote there, was simply commenting on the automatic operation of a federal statute. Here, we don't even have a majority comment on the automatic operation of a federal statute. We simply have a kind of a grab bag of separate commissioner statements commenting on it.
How do you distinguish RTNDA? Is it just that it's mandamus?
That's one critical distinction. The RTNDA decision, of course, is unpublished, so it's not really precedent for anything.
The second one's published.
The second one is published, but the second one did not readopt or reaffirm the jurisdictional holding of the unpublished order. To the contrary, it simply cited it as law of the case and said we're bound by that jurisdictional discussion. It dropped a footnote to an en banc decision of this court saying that even when a subsequent panel disagrees with the jurisdictional holding of a prior panel, it's nonetheless bound to follow it under law of the case principles. So there's no published readoption of the RTNDA. RTNDA remedy. In any event, in RTNDA, there was no statute that specified the consequences of agency inaction. And in the absence of such, and here we, of course, do have, as Your Honors had mentioned before, we have a statute that tells us what happens when there's agency inaction. We don't have to make creative use, or the court doesn't have to make creative use of its mandamus authority or any other authority to figure out what happened here. In the absence of such a statutory specification in RTNDA, the court perceived the need to make creative use of its mandamus power to get itself and get all the parties out of an intractable situation.
Did you
say
we were being creative in that case?
I think I think the court was being creative, and in fact, the remedy that was used in RTNDA was in fact proposed by the FCC's general counsel at the time at oral argument. Everyone was looking for a way out of that situation. There had been a petition for rulemaking that had been pending for 15 years. Two separate groups of commissioners had deadlocked 2-2. On how to resolve that particular petition. It was in an area of First Amendment sensitivity, and no one really kind of saw a way out until this court, at the urging of the FCC's general counsel, kind of decided to adopt or apply very distinct procedural rules that apply to the Federal Elections Commission.
What's your answer to the point that the petitioners make, that if in fact you're correct, it's just a convenient way for commissioners to insulate their grants, forbearance petitions from judicial review just by withholding a vote?
Well, there's certainly no history of that happening.
That's not the point. We have the history right here. So the question is,
well, the history here is nothing but a good faith inability to reach a majority position on an order.
There's a statutory requirement that the agency in these kinds of cases is supposed to act pursuant to established criteria, unlike AT&T, where the statute just expired. I don't see AT&T as being anywhere like this case. That was just a statutory expiration. The commission could wave its arms or nothing. They could ignore it, let the day pass, and the statute's gone.
It's an expiration.
This is a case where there are very specific statutory provisions that govern whether you do or do not forbear, and the agency is the official actor on behalf of the government to decide whether that does or does not happen.
That's correct. I think Congress contemplated that in the vast majority of cases, the agency would apply those standards. But what Congress wanted to do was provide a specific deregulatory result when a majority of the commission could not adopt an order applying those standards.
And we don't need to know the reasons for that deregulatory result. See, that's the question. They did. You just said exactly what I thought. The commission did establish a deregulatory result by virtue of how they handled this case.
Now the automatic operation of the statute did, you're right.
Now the question is, can we insist on a reasoned explanation for that result, which they understood under the statute that governs their actions would take place? Can't we insist? I mean, consistent with the authority I'm citing, and this case cites other cases, which said if we can't discern a reasoned explanation here, we can send it back and say, this is the result you produced. You've got to give us a reasoned explanation for it.
Right, you're alluding to the petitioner's argument that even when there's a deemed grant, the commission still owes an analysis under the 10A factors to justify or defend the deemed grant.
Yeah, because in NLRB cases, the votes will produce a result.
Right.
In the cases that I'm talking about, they produce a result, and everyone on the board understood it. But there were three or four different opinions, so there was no clear explanation. Everyone understood judicial review flows from those results, but there was no discernible reasoned explanation. We sent it back and said, this is inadequate. You have to explain this.
Right. That was because you had the NLRB in that context. I apologize. I'm not familiar with the case, but had to explain the action that it took. Here, the commission, by definition, took no action.
That it reached.
Here, the commission.
Because all of those board members would have said, we all did something different, but there was a result. And we said, you've got to explain the result.
Right, but I don't think in that context there was a statute that specified the result. Here we have a statute that specifies the result, and that result is only triggered when the commission does not take action.
The statutory result is specified. If a certain number of members on the board don't vote a certain way, you'll either get it dismissed or granted. So you have a result that comes from the statute, but you have no explanation explaining how the agency got there.
Well, here under Section 10, the deemed grant occurs only when the agency has done nothing, when the agency hasn't taken action. It's not going to be able to explain or justify the deemed grant because it's not an action that the agency took.
Well, that's what we're
just as a logical matter.
That's what we're trying to decide.
I would also point out, Your Honor, that
because it really is. I mean, the problem for me, in any event, it seems the height of absurdity in this kind of a situation where the statute is so clear that the agency has got to give an explanation before they allow forbearance and explain precisely how far they're going to let a carrier go. It's subject to agency oversight. To then say if you get lucky because there's a tie vote, no explanation is necessary and you have the whole bundle.
I think Congress was putting a thumb on the scales in favor of deregulation and said if a majority can't come up with a rationale to deny deregulation, you're going to get deregulation, you're going to get a deregulatory result. I would also point out, Your Honor, that this particular argument by petitioners is barred by Section 405. So even if there is a reviewable order here, and we don't think there is, the petitioners were obligated to seek reconsideration and come to the agency for the first time with this question, the question being, when there's a deemed grant under Section 10C.
So now they've done something that they can seek reconsideration of. Come on.
No,
I was wondering whether you were going to throw that one out. It's like, come on. You can't be kidding.
No, Your Honor,
you can't have it both ways. Now, I'll accept that as a possibility because then you're accepting my premise that the agency did something.
Absolutely not, Your Honor. We are arguing the alternative. There was no order here. There was no decisional pronouncement by a majority of the commission. If we're wrong about that, if there was an order, then the petitioners were obligated to seek reconsideration and raise with the agency this particular argument that's based on their statutory construction. They're arguing that when there's a deemed grant under Section 10C.
So they can go back and just file a new petition?
Well, the other carriers have asked the commission to issue an order in this docket.
I understand. They can go back then to cure that alleged failure of exhaustion. They can just go back and petition the agency for review of this.
Well, the time for reconsideration has expired.
No, not for reconsideration. They can file for re-review. Do you think this is a closed matter? You're the only one I haven't asked so far. Do you think that the agency has the authority to revisit this?
Well, this touches on the language which we provided to the court last week in which the commission granted what we call a Me Too petition by AT&T, which sought substantially the same relief that Verizon sought here. And in paragraph 50 of that petition, the commission alluded to a future order that it expected to issue dealing with the Verizon.
So that means the commission
petition
thinks it can reconsider.
Well, I can't commit the commission to any particular
I'll ask
course
you to
of action.
Read the language. The language that we're given doesn't appear to have any other explanation. You got another explanation for how they could reconsider without being able to reconsider?
No, I don't. I just want to be careful because the order will speak for itself when it's issued. But I can tell you my reading of that language is the same as yours, which is that the commission believes that the Verizon petition is still pending, and the commission believes that it can issue a decision on the merits of that petition for the first time.
And we can expedite that by saying there's no reasoned decision-making here for the result that they reach.
It's really a separate question because we have the deemed grant that happened by operation of law. It wasn't due to any action by the agency.
Well, I'm going with your alternative argument now.
If my alternative argument is accepted, then the court has no jurisdiction for a separate reason, which is Section 405.
They can then refile a petition.
Right, but that wouldn't be part of this case. They could ask for declaratory relief. There are any number of avenues that would be available to them.
Right. Is the only thing you claim that they should have exhausted is the argument that a 2-2 vote is a denial?
No, we do claim they should have exhausted that. Again, assuming there was an order, our first position is there was no order. We do think they should have and did not exhaust that. But the separate 405 argument is the one I was alluding to before. They argue that if there's a deemed grant that takes place under Section 10C, the commission has an obligation to issue a statement of reasons under Section 10A justifying that deemed grant. That's a particular argument of statutory construction that they have not presented to the commission. And this court has not been shy about imposing Section 405 requirements on petitioners in forbearance cases when they bring up an argument of statutory construction that has to do with how the deemed grant provision operates. The Core case, the Quest Omaha case are examples.
Well, what else is that they were supposed to seek on reconsideration, forgetting that particular argument? What else were they supposed to seek?
Well, we've also advanced a Section 405 argument with respect to Mr. Murray's argument that there was actually a denial here. Of course, nobody else perceived this denial. All four commissioners thought that the petition had been deemed granted by operation of law. But we do suggest that to the extent there was an order, and again, I would ask Mr. Murray what order he's talking about. Maybe it's the press release issued by the staff. But to the extent there was an order, petitioners were obligated to file for reconsideration of that quote-unquote order and press their argument that, in fact, there was a denial, despite what all four participating commissioners thought. And finally, I'd like to mention that Mr. Murray referred to our briefs in the Core case and the Quest case. Those cases dealt with a very different situation. There was a majority vote on an order disposing of petitions in those cases before the statutory deadline. And the issue was, in those cases was, did the agency have an obligation to get the actual order out by the statutory deadline, or was the majority vote sufficient by itself? So that those cases didn't deal with this situation at all.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ralph.
Thank you, Your Honors. Scott Angstrich representing the interveners in support of the FCC. To start with Judge Edwards' pending question, we do agree that the Commission is not forever disempowered from reimposing or re-regulating Verizon, that we don't think the petition is actually still pending before the Commission. We think that the Commission, in a new proceeding on a new record, taking into account, among other things, the market realities of the past 19 months when Verizon has not been subject to these regulations, we think that record would show that the rules in question aren't required. But on such a full record, reflecting today's conditions as opposed to the way things were back in March 2006, if the Commission were to find some kind of market failure that would justify reimposition of regulations, then the fact that the petition had been deemed granted doesn't stand in the way of that. We'd take that up at that time. We don't think
so,
they could
so
find it.
So forbearance is not forever?
Whether by commission action or by inaction and operation of law, that's correct.
But when it's by operation of law, you still have to, they would still have to thereafter find a change in circumstances from the date of the operation by law?
I don't think it'd be a change in circumstances so much as a reflection of current circumstances. And current circumstances would include the actions of the parties in question during the time in which the regulatory provisions did not apply. We do think that there is no final order here and there is no Hobbs Act jurisdiction, which is the only source of jurisdiction that the petitioners have cited here, that the best way to understand what Congress did in Section 10 was to be, A, concerned about agency delay, but also to be of the view that if the agency within 15 months, which was significantly longer than the Senate would have given about 150 days maximum, in 15 months the agency couldn't muster a reasoned explanation for why the rules or statutory provisions in question were necessary to protect consumers or to protect the public interest or to ensure just and reasonable rates, then in all likelihood those rules in question were not. And therefore, Congress wanted those rules to cease to apply. I think that does make it quite like the Section 272 sunset case, where there Congress didn't adopt a fixed three-year provision, but going off on some of Judge Edwards' prior questions, there had to have been agency action before that three-year period even started to run.
Is that we go back to this? I just don't know the answer to this. The Hobbs Act, or at least by saying, can review orders of the Federal Communication Commission. Has that been interpreted to include something, a review of something that is not formally an order, as long as it's final agency action?
I think as long as it is in fact an order of the Commission acting as an entity. In the Verizon telephone case from 2004 involving a different forbearance case, the agency denominated its document a public notice, but the document also made clear that it was adopted by a majority, in fact, I think by a unanimous vote in that case. It contained an explanation.
It doesn't have to be a formal.
It doesn't have to call itself memorandum, opinion, and order, or order and opinion.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it does have to be a statement of the Commission
the
speaking
FCC
as an entity.
The FCC doesn't designate their orders anyway, do they?
They do often use the term order, often it's memorandum opinion in order, or sometimes it's report in order, that they use a lot of. What they do tend to do, though, is they place an FCC and then a two-digit year and a document number for identification purposes. The public notice in the Verizon telephone case carried one. There is no document here that carries any such description because there is nothing that reflects the views of the commission acting as an entity.
Did the commission in their follow-up action in favor of AT&T forbear to the full extent that Verizon had originally requested or something short of that?
They did not grant the full relief that Verizon believes it had obtained through the deemed grant. No,
so they're forecasting a change, probably.
It does seem that way, Your Honor, and we may well be back here when that change occurs. I think the final issue here is does get to the question of what is to be reviewed. I don't think either the commissioners who would have voted for relief and the commissioners who would have voted for no relief thought they were writing an order. I don't think you can expect to create a future rule that would lead to this without changing the way the commission does its internal voting. As the commission explains in its brief, an order is prepared and one votes to adopt that order in full or not to adopt it in full. They don't have a situation where you can sign on to an opinion in parts or different commissioners, as in the NLRB, can reach different results for different reasons and then lead to a result at the end. They could potentially adopt such a voting system, but they haven't, and we don't think it's for this court to police that voting system and that the commission has happened to adopt it. Again, it's our position there's no jurisdiction here. You see my time is running out if there are no questions.
Thank you.
Okay, why don't you both take 2 minutes, 2 minutes each.
Very quickly, it's our position, Your Honor, there was agency action here. We think the court has jurisdiction under Section 704 and 706 of the APA to review that. You can set aside an erroneous conclusion. We think there plainly was one here as to the effect of the 2-2 vote.
The APA is not the jurisdictional statute.
Yes, Your Honor, but I think that you do have jurisdiction, and certainly you can apply those standards in
under
reviewing.
Under 402, right?
Pardon me?
Under 402.
Yes, Your Honor. With respect to exhaustion, this court has found that Section 405 is not a jurisdictional exhaustion requirement and has recognized exceptions. Obviously, we could not seek reconsideration about something that we didn't know until 4 months after the deadline for seeking reconsideration had expired. And lastly, I find it ironic to hear the FCC taking the position here that Congress intended to tip the scale towards.
You didn't know.
We did not know that a timely vote had occurred on the Verizon petition and that there had been a deadlock 2-2 vote. That was disclosed for the first time in response to a senatorial inquiry in September of 2006.
But the statements were released contemporaneously?
The statements were released contemporaneously with the press release and indicated
on
March 20th, 2006, and indicated only that the agency had been unable to act on the petition. Did not indicate that a vote had taken place.
And was that reviewable, did you think? What did you think at that point? Was it a denial?
We filed a timely petition for review.
Right. So you thought there was a denial at that point?
We believed that at that point we did not know that there had been a vote taken on the petition.
How would you characterize what had happened at that point?
Then I think there was no doubt agency action that had a consequence.
And what
here.
Agency action?
The action of having a petition before it and failing to act on it with the intelligible principles set forth in Section 10.
And the intelligible 10. Principles were in the four statements?
No, the principles set forth in Section 10A and B.
Right, but if, again, on the question of what we were to review under those circumstances, would it have been the four statements?
I think that the court has, I believe the court has discretion to take the record here, the petition of Verizon, the statements of the commissioners, and to review those
right.
as final agency action. If that's not sufficient, then the proper course would be a remand for
so
a more reasoned explanation.
About the 2-2 vote, you already knew how the petitioners were deciding at that point, right?
At that point, all we knew was that there had been agency, quote, inaction, close quote, and that there was a difference of view about the result. It was only after Chairman Martin disclosed, in response to a specific question by the Senate, what did you actually do, that we knew that a vote, a timely vote, had been taken And of course, we've seen what the FCC's position was in the Core and Quest cases about the consequences of taking a vote.
What's the case law on 405, jurisdictional and non-jurisdictional?
Yes, it's non-jurisdictional, Your Honor, and that goes to the WATC v. FCC case, 712 F. 2nd at 692.
Case is, those cases are really in doubt now.
Well, I assume you're reviewing, you're referring to the Booth v. Turner decision. But there, the Supreme Court was very specific in its holding that it was only ruling that the particular statute in the Prison Litigation Reform Act had the sort of clear, direct language of Congress to evince an intent to make the exhaustion requirement jurisdictional.
This says a petition for reconsideration is not a prerequisite to judicial review unless,
yes,
unless you're presenting an argument to the court that was not presented to the commission.
Which reflects a prudential concern about giving the agency an opportunity to explain itself. But in this case, Your Honor, we had 30 days to seek reconsideration.
That you were required, if you had an argument, you were required to present it to the commission.
And we didn't have the argument. That's the problem, Your Honor. We didn't know until September of 2006 that there had been a vote. And that's the issue before you. What was the consequence of that vote? And I'll just conclude by saying,
before you conclude, can I ask you to track,
yes,
the statute for a second? So the statute says any such petition shall be deemed granted if the commission does not deny the petition, et cetera. Your view is that they did deny the petition.
Correct,
right?
Your Honor.
Right. What do you do with the remainder of that sentence? Does not deny the petition for failure to meet the requirements for forbearance. You think it was denied for failure to meet the requirements for forbearance?
Absolutely.
It wasn't denied just because it was a two vote.
I think that if you look at the statements of Commissioners Adelstein and Copps, they explain in significant detail why the standards for forbearance were not satisfied. And I believe, in fact, Commissioner Copps gives eight examples.
If it had only been a 2-2 vote without any reasons given, you would also say it was a denial.
Yes, I would. But
because of the Latin maxim.
Yes, and there I would say, like the RTNDA case, you would have to ask the two dissenting commissioners to supply a reasoned explanation for their view.
Well, but
here you've already got it.
Hold on for a second.
Sorry.
But the statute doesn't say that. The statute only applies when they don't deny the petition for failure to meet the requirements for forbearance. If they deny the petition for some other reason, namely they can't get a majority, namely they just can't get their act together, what happens then?
Then I think that my colleague's arguments about what happens, in fact, become the more relevant question.
Well, what about from the meaning of the words of the statute?
Here,
how
I
do you
think
get to anything? If let's say all the members stated we're going to deny the petition for some other reason, not for failure to meet the requirements. We just couldn't get our act together.
Then we may have an argument that that was arbitrary and capricious because Congress specified what the grounds would be for denying the petition. But here, the statements of the two dissenting commissioners make clear that the reason they voted no was because the statutory criteria, in their view, were not met.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors. I'd like to make one practical point first. At the same time that the chairman announced that there had been a 2-2 vote, he also announced, as is virtually always the case with the FCC, that he circulated a draft order to the commissioners 21 days before the deadline. I just want to point out that there would have been no practical problem with the chairman and Commissioner Tate issuing some more elaborate statement rather than choosing to issue such a brief statement. I would also note that
what's the point, though?
To the extent the court's worried about a practical problem with the two commissioners producing a reviewable order, there really isn't. It was a decision not to do that here. And those in their joint statement,
no, I didn't mean what the point was of your argument. What would be the point of them issuing some elaborate, 50 or 60 page order on forbearance when they couldn't get a majority?
Well, if you agree that it was deemed granted, and if you also agree that it would it is reviewable, there's no practical problem producing an order that's more elaborate than the one at issue. That's my practical point. If I can turn to the enforcement authority question for a minute, This is a very important miscommunication here. If this is simply, if forbearance is simply a decision by the government not to enforce the statute, that certainly changes the constitutional issue. But it would also mean that the carriers could go to court, district court under Section 206, and get injunction damages and attorney's fees, for instance, if Verizon decided to stop filing tariffs as required under Section 203. If all forbearance is a statement that the government's not going to enforce the tariffing provision or the 47 other requirements of Title II, that says nothing about our ability to do it. And given the clear language of Section 203, we'd have an open and shut case if they stopped complying with the statute.
Now, I don't know how much this matters since nobody has been arguing it, but the statute does talk about forbearance from enforcing, right? Those are the words of the statute. That's why I asked it in that way.
It certainly isn't, despite that language, it certainly doesn't seem that that's why Congress enacted Section 10. It clearly had this court's de-tariffing decisions in mind, and I think that it certainly intended company like Verizon, once it got a proper grant of forbearance, to not have to file tariffs. But if I'm wrong about that, and it really is the central point of the government's response in its briefs to the constitutional issue, I'd be happy to learn that from the court. A brief response to Mr. Angstrich about how well Verizon has behaved. Verizon is earning 50% rates of return on its special access products under the under the commission's formal data. That's not a rate of return that anyone has ever thought to be just and reasonable. And if I may, I'd like to end by endorsing Judge Edwards' statement that it would be the height of absurdity for the close cases where the commission deadlocks to be the only one that aren't subject to judicial review. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. Case is submitted.